Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Greetings to all of you listening around the world, and a warm welcome to another edition of the Answers for the Family radio show. I'm your guest host today, Gabriela Van Rey, because Alan is unfortunately sick today. For any of you who knew Greg Shoemaker, a former co-host, he used to do a character as a comedian called the Love Master. And this is how Alan's voice actually sounded this morning over the phone. He really can't speak. And so I'm filling in. As many of you are aware, Alan is an international detective, and I'd love to be able to tell you that he was called out of state on another case, but as you know, he's just really ill today. I have been a guest host several times in both 2017 and 2018 with Alan, and it's always fun because one of the things he does is he tries to make every guest make a positive difference in the lives of others. And he needs your help to be a show ambassador. What does that mean? A show ambassador means that we need your help to at least just share one show on your social media timeline. And by doing that, we will get truly around the world with your help, and more people will benefit from hearing this show. Each week, we showcase an issue such as locating a runaway teen, family crisis intervention, building self-esteem, dealing with addiction, increasing our quality of life or longevity, and so much more. Alan has told me that he and Jan Chapin, the show producer, choose top professionals in many of the helping fields, skilled authors that they believe are working to make the world a better place for all. And if you're wondering what I do, I'm Gabriela, and I am the founder of the Dare to Be Kind, a global movement. It is very simple what we do. We believe that kindness can only grow more kindness. And we say that the mission that we have is to create a safer world. The method is kindness, and the vehicle is you. Our topic for today, and our guest for today, her name is Christine Forner. And the topic is dissociation, mindfulness, and creative meditation, which is also the title of our guest's new book. She will discuss these subjects and more. Christine has more than 17 years of clinical experience working with individuals with trauma, PTSD, traumatic dissociation, and development trauma. Christine works in private practice at Associated Counseling in Calgary, Alberta, Canada. She has presented locally and internationally on issues of traumatic dissociation and mindfulness and dissociation, and is the current treasurer for the International Society for the Study of Trauma and Dissociation. Christine, welcome to Answers for the Family. I am so happy to have you here.
I'm really grateful for being here. Thank you.
When I read your materials and what you do, I had a smile, just said that you know that, from ear to ear, because you couldn't come at a more opportune moment because of everything that is happening with children in our country in detention centers. So just so you know, I am really excited to kind of dig in to what you have there, because it's when I read your material, it's a lot of information and we need to try to get all of it in. But where I would like to start is just that you start, just totally spontaneous, a little bit about your topic, about your new book.
Well, the book really is an accumulation of many years of trying to work with the population that I have been working with for almost for two decades now. I work with people who experience the most difficult human conditions. So I typically start where most therapists stop.
Okay.
And in working with that population, you really get an understanding of what it creates or what is needed to create a human being who thrives, and what conditions create human beings to act or seem or like to be hurt. And in doing this journey, I started discovering different types of meditation, different types of healing, different types of modalities. And I'm one of the first people to really look at dissociation through the eyes of mindfulness. And because of that, it's very developmental. It's very based on human relationships. Working with dissociation helps you see what a human needs to thrive. And in looking at that through the eyes of mindfulness, I started really to understand or see mindfulness as a relational part of a human being. It's a developmental milestone, I do believe.
Mm-hmm.
And you really can see with science and with studies and with people who are being raised in safe and secure environments versus people who are raised in unsafe and insecure environments, how there is this amazing human capacity built within us. It's part of our mechanics, not really part of what we do. It's part of who we are as a species. We are supposed to be incredibly loving. We are supposed to be incredibly kind. It's in our brain structure.
Mm-hmm. I would agree totally with you on that.
Yeah,
really. But I love that you bring mindfulness into it, and I've never, ever heard anyone say that. So I know that's really unique. But before we dive into that part, would you describe, because for the average listener, I think we understand what dissociation is, but we really don't understand what state, what causes it. So maybe delve a little bit deeper into just that term for us to understand in layman's terms.
Yeah. And I tried to do that as much as I could in the book. I tried to really make it digestible. What dissociation is, traumatic dissociation is it, most people are pretty familiar with the fight and flight instincts inside of us. Very few people are familiar with the freeze instinct. So they work very differently. Fight and flight is very action orientated. So the body moves into action. It wants to run away. It wants to be able to move to protect itself. But if the body, not the mind, but if the body, the human mechanical body, deems that fighting or fleeing is dangerous or too dangerous or not a good way to get out, or if there is no way to get out, then freeze kicks in. And freeze does a lot of different things than the fight and flight. Freeze shuts things down. Freeze stops us from thinking clearly. Freeze turns off the mechanisms that can make meaning and sense out of the events that are happening to us. Freeze numbs out our feelings. It numbs out our sensations. It disconnects. So it stops the brain from making connected information. And so basically what it does is it shuts the body down, shuts the mind down, shuts feelings down as much as it can to survive the last, it's sort of the last ditch effort.
And would you say that the way you made it sound, it's automatic, right? It's not something
it is.
That you can do
it
anything
is.
About.
No, it's very, a good way to look at the human brain is we sort of have three brains inside of one. There's kind of this reptilian basic brain, and on top of that is a more developed mammalian brain. And on top of that is the more developed human brain, and they all are supposed to work together.
Mm-hmm.
But that human brain takes about 25 years to grow.
Yep.
And that human brain is supposed to be managing that mammal and reptilian brain. The mammal and reptilian brain, those things are basically fully set when we are born. But the human brain takes a really long time to grow. That mammal brain is reactive, instinctual, and automatic. So if that has decided that this is what it needs to do in order to survive, then it happens without our conscious awareness.
Okay. Okay, wow. I did not know that it was truly, totally automatic. And is freeze, would you consider the word freeze a little bit like that debilitating when you're so fearful that you're kind of like paralyzed?
Yeah.
Would freeze be
identical? So we kind of have a hard freeze that's part of action. So if you think about, you know, walking in the forest 50,000 years ago when there was like 25 different species or something like that of saber-toothed tigers, right? We are, we don't fight all that well. So we don't have really good claws. We don't have really good teeth. We are really slow compared to other mammals, and we're really not strong compared to other mammals.
Mm-hmm.
So 50,000 years ago, if we're walking through the forest and we detect danger, the first thing the human body tends to do is a hard freeze. That's still active. It is kind of paralyzed. This is a much deeper freeze that we become like it's feigned death or tonic immobility or complete submission. So like we have pictures of people's brains when they're in this state and there's no electrical currents running through. Whereas within fight or flight, there's electrical currents in particular parts of the brain that are related to action or freezing action or running.
Mm-hmm.
So this one, there's nothing going on.
And the freeze happens afterwards. Is that correct? So
it can and it can't. It depends, right?
Oh.
So if we're talking about adults, mm-hmm. Typically it's the last thing to kick in. But if we're talking about kids, kids don't run all that well.
No,
they're not strong. The first thing their bodies tend to do is dissociate, play dead, waiting for another human being to come and save them, or anesthetizing things so that they don't feel the full feelings of the pain and suffering.
Okay. That seems absolutely logical. Wow. That's quite an explanation for most of us to learn about. And
mm-hmm.
How did you find the connection between this dissociation and the connection with mindfulness?
I started my own journey, and I was a single mom. Well, I was going through personal issues at home, but I was also raising three little kids on my own, and I was going to university getting my master's degree, and I stopped sleeping. My mother recommended I start taking this class, and it was more of a spiritual self-improvement class, but it was heavily based on creative meditations or imagery meditations.
Mm-hmm.
And I started to become fascinated because it actually helped me sleep, and I was curious, what is going on with me? And when you start studying about meditation and mindfulness, most of the information is about mindfulness, which is a little different than what I was doing. And I just started becoming curious, and I started taking classes, and I went to a conference in Boston many, many years ago. And as I was looking at the dissociative brain, which I knew pretty well at that time, I started comparing it to the mindful brain, and I thought to myself, these things are very different brains. They're like rival brain activities.
Mm-hmm.
And the more that I have looked at this, the more that I have studied this, the more I really do believe that the dissociation becomes phobic of mindfulness, and we mm-hmm. really need mindfulness. So in working with my population, I started trying to figure out ways to help them understand mindfulness in an easier way versus the actual act of mindfulness, which is a pretty difficult task, honestly.
Yeah. Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Well,
yeah.
I'm glad your mother recommended that.
So am I.
Because we all benefit of everything that you learned. And do they, it's a question that I think a lot of us wonder if in the therapy business, is this now recognized, the connection between dissociation and mindful life, or has it not been that widely spread yet?
I've been doing this for a very long time, and I've only run across one other paper, like a study that compared dissociation and mindfulness, and the study basically suggested that people who dissociate can really benefit from mindfulness. Because I learned most of what I learned in the office with my clients, figuring these things out over the last 20 years, I warn a lot of people about people diving into mindfulness if they have dissociative tendencies, right? Mindfulness is about awareness, knowing oneself, knowing one's feelings, being tolerated feelings, mm-hmm. being able to tolerate sensations.
Mm-hmm.
People who dissociate or chronically dissociate, they're dissociating because what they've been through hurts.
Mm-hmm.
It's painful. painful emotionally, painfully physically. It's really hard to comprehend some of the things that have happened to them, so they don't really want to know what's happened. The system fights actually really hard in knowing once it's dissociating.
So the system wants to forget? Is that what you're saying?
What's that?
Does the system want to forget? Is that what you're
yes,
saying?
Okay. It does. Okay. It does. It works hard at not knowing if it doesn't feel safe enough to know. And most people who dissociate don't understand safety. They just don't, especially if it's you spend a lot of time dissociating or if you have a dissociative disorder. Safety becomes really, really scary, right? So you think about people. They are dealing or living in the last line of defense. The only thing after that is death. If they've been there a really long time, the system doesn't even know safety. Mm-hmm. Safety is new, and anything new scares these systems because they're already terrified.
Gotcha.
So they tend to be people with dissociative disorders. They are very hard to heal because all the things that they need are things that really are unknown. And if it's unknown, the system's just going to assume it's more bad stuff because they don't know a lot of good stuff.
So how come our culture does such a bad job, if I may say so, in not teaching this? How come we're unwilling?
You know, it actually baffles me. I do think that there is a dissociation about dissociation.
Sorry, that was spontaneous. I couldn't hold that one back, Christine. That is excellent. Would you repeat that? Because I think our listeners would love it.
We experience dissociation about dissociation.
Yeah.
It's really hard for people to look at this because most of us want to believe or have been told that we were raised in good homes, that the world is there to support us, but many of us don't actually have those experiences.
Mm-hmm.
If you have any issues with money or poverty, if there's any issues with alcoholism, mental illness, child abuse is an incredibly common thing. 1 in 3 girls and 1 in 5 boys are sexually assaulted before the age of 18.
Yep.
That's an extremely common experience. But it's hard to look at it. If you've experienced it, it will bring up your own feelings, and those own feelings tend to dissociate.
Mm-hmm.
It's really hard for us to sit and look at these things, either because it is so far from our experience, but I'm not sure that's such true, because if you're raised in a safe environment, you tend to have the compassion to sit with this.
Mm-hmm.
Most of us, I think it's personal, unfortunately, and I don't mean that in a mean or harsh way. It's just really hard to look at pain and suffering when you can't be objective to it,
mm-hmm.
when you can't be mindful about it. When you see pain and suffering, you yourself are going to experience pain and suffering. And then if your body can't handle that, dissociation kicks in.
Gotcha. So we almost have a problem then with the empathy part. The compassion is there, but we can't go all the way? Is that
I think it's a combination.
Mm-hmm.
What we know is when people are mindful,
mm-hmm.
there tend to be like 9 different things that are a side effect of being mindful. Those side effects are the same side effects we have when we are raised in a secure environment. One of them is being able to regulate our fear. The other one is to regulate our emotions. So be able to have emotions, understand them, and be one with them, including the really intense ones.
So
mindfulness helps us take a mental pause.
Mm-hmm.
So it gives us a chance to go, oh, what is really going on here? It gives us awareness of insight and intuition. It helps us be empathic, but empathy is sort of in a different way. It's to be able to feel what other people feel, but know that's their feelings and not our feelings, which is a very sophisticated thing, very adult thing.
Yeah.
We spend 25 years trying to figure that out. Mindfulness also helps us with something called attunement, being able to feel, know, and sense what another human is going through and be able to get it right. All of those things, if you're connecting with another human being, that's the level we're supposed to be connecting with people.
Mm-hmm.
We should be able to feel them and sense them and know them and know that that's theirs and still be in control of ours. Mm-hmm. If we don't really have that, then we get close to people and our mechanics start to tune in. And if they are going through distress and we don't know that how to manage and master our own distress, then boom, we go into our own personal stress. mm-hmm. and we lose social engagement.
Wow, really interesting. I have a question that I have here on, is dissociation recognized as depression or anxiety, borderline personality? And if so, are they connected? Because to me, they don't sound connected at all. But maybe they are.
There's a similarity. People with dissociative disorders, and even if you go the full spectrum of dissociative identity disorder, mm-hmm. if you are able to see dissociation from the beginning, right? Okay. So you have a small child or an infant. So let's go to some of these kids that are sitting in these places where mom and dads are no longer there.
Absolutely.
Their little bodies don't know how to save themselves. They don't know how to soothe themselves. This whole thing about teaching children to self-soothe is such a massive myth. The physical human body is unable to soothe itself for many years, like decades, mm-hmm. fully and completely, right? So you have this little tiny body who is in extraordinary distress, mm-hmm. and no one is helping that body. That body will be dissociating very quickly within 6 hours or within instantly or within days. So in days, most of these kids are going to be experiencing dissociation a little or a lot. Okay. Some people are born with a preference to dissociate. Some people are born with a preference to fight or to flee. So the anxieties tend to be, and I'm just explaining this in really simple terms. Mm-hmm. The science behind it is a little different and not so black and white.
Okay.
But basically, things like PTSD and complex PTSD, they're still active. So the system is moving, still trying to move, but not able to help itself. Mm-hmm. So that's more the PTSD. The borderlines tend to be the rage ones, the anger ones, that the system keeps moving into fight. The choreography for these things are all quite different on the inside.
So you're saying that's innate, though, the ones that fight.
It's a preference, typically.
Is that conscious?
That's what it looks like right now. What's that?
Do they make that? Because I'm trying to, we all saw these horrible images on television. So I'm trying to imagine, I'm a very visual person. I'm trying to imagine this tiny little toddler that we saw on the ground, right? And she sees her mother leave. I mean, she sees it on top of it. It's not even while she's sleeping.
Yeah.
She sees the caregiver been taken away. So by what you're saying, well, she tried to talk, right? Because she actually did talk. I mean, there's a little audio file on that where she tries to understand what's going on.
That would be an attachment cry.
Okay, that's an attachment cry. Okay, I'm trying to understand.
It's a defense. Another way to look at it. So as complicated as these things are, in simplifying it, I'm not really explaining the science as much as we could with like a research paper.
No,
but
I understand.
Pretty much what's happening in that child, as soon as a body moves into a defense, it's no longer ordinary consciousness.
Yeah.
Right. So if you think about something like temperature, mm-hmm. right, you have a little baby body that has the temperature of, the human body is supposed to be at 98 degrees.
Okay.
If it starts getting cold, there's things the body's going to try and do to warm it up.
Yeah.
But for children, because they are in risk of getting cold and getting damaged much quicker than adults, they're going to cry out for help because they don't know how to make themselves warm. They can't pick up a blanket. They can't, like, especially when we're first born, mm-hmm. we can't go and protect ourselves and take care of ourselves. All we can do is cry out for help. And if that help isn't there, then we move into the defense. The body then starts going, okay, now we have to prepare to not die versus preparing to get back to baseline. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, you explained that beautifully.
So,
yes, continue.
And it's the same with hot, right? So mm-hmm. if a baby body starts getting hot, it's going to cry out, there's a problem. Mm-hmm. The body will try and get itself back to normal by sweating. Mm-hmm. But if that doesn't work, then it starts moving into a defense. It mm-hmm. moves into a different way of being. It's now preparing to not die. Mm-hmm. And with those little bodies, it happens so quick because there is nothing inside a human baby body that is capable of caring for itself.
Yeah.
Everything inside that body is 100% dependent upon its parent. Mm-hmm. Right? So if you take a look at like zebras and caribou, within hours, those ones, they are able to run away. They're able to defend themselves a little bit by running within, you know, a day or two of being born.
Mm-hmm.
They can kind of survive on their own.
Mm-hmm.
They don't really change. Like, their gestation period is kind of all inside, not outside.
Mm-hmm.
But humans' gestation period is decades.
Yeah.
Those little baby bodies cannot do anything for themselves. And so those baby bodies will cry. They'll do an attachment cry. If that attachment cry doesn't work, then the body starts preparing. How do I not die? How do I linger here as long as possible, hopefully having another human come and get me?
So how much damage are we doing to these children at the border?
I don't think there's a limit to what I can tell you.
But maybe it's my fault. I'm saying the question wrong. I don't think any of us have that answer, but I mean, what? Maybe what
time's
signs?
Time's infinity. How about that?
Oh,
that's,
yeah.
That's my answer. Time's infinity.
I love it.
This is the most amount of damage you can do to a human being.
But let's, okay, because possibly, I know. Let's take a child, maybe that everyone can relate to, that, you know, because I relate to those children at the border for the reason that I'm an adoptee. But so I just feel so bad for them, you know. Compassion lies very high for me on that level. But let's take a child that maybe we can relate to. A mom that dies when the child is 2 years old, or a divorce. Children do go to the fathers these days. They don't always stay with moms. Even if it's temporary, even if it's a grandma, you know, a split up, something that all of us that are listening can relate to. What does this child in the future, let's say that this child is only disassociated from their family member for, I'm just going to say, a year, while everything works out, everything goes back to normal, the child lives again with the mom.
There's still going to be the experience inside that body of abandonment.
Exactly.
And because it's so important or imperative for our living, because that's really all the human body wants to do, it just wants to live. Everything inside of us is driving towards a baseline of being alive and thriving. That body is going to feel and sense that separation for the rest of its life. And it's going to, that's going to sort of be its magnetic north for the rest of its life, unless there is the resources and the therapy and the education to help that person understand what's happened to them. This isn't through thinking right now.
Mm-hmm.
These kids are experiencing the worst of the worst.
Gotcha.
And their bodies are reacting to that. And after a year of separation, they're all going to likely leave with some type of massive attachment disorder, or dissociative disorder, or complex trauma disorder, or antisocial disorders.
But do they have signs that might, that we just don't even notice? I mean,
absolutely.
That a regular parent just kind of says, my child seems balanced, she or he has friends, you know, they look okay, they get good grades, you know. It's hard for parents to really know unless children are really communicative. But I presume...
Well, not really, right? So if we're mindful as adults, we're going to be able to produce a mindful child.
Okay.
That's just what happens.
Yeah.
If you yourself are a mindful parent, repairs can happen. So we take something like an adopted baby.
Mm-hmm.
If you have a mindful parent who's able to help articulate to that child the experiences that they felt when they were adopted, because that baby body is going to go, I don't recognize anything. Because I don't recognize anything, I don't recognize any sight, sound, taste, touch, smell, that must be dangerous, so I'm going to start shutting down to protect myself. That's typically what baby bodies do after they've been adopted. getting an adopted family coming in and saying, you're safe now, you're cared for now, these are your new sounds, remember your old sounds, that baby body can become pretty resilient because there's a safety around it and a labeling of the feelings that that child had.
Mm-hmm.
There's a meaning and context to that, that lack of space or that lack of moment when they were in that unfamiliar area.
Mm-hmm.
So a child can become resilient because those moms and dads are attempting to fill in this blank, so to speak.
Gotcha.
But I doubt any of these parents are going to have those types of resources, and I doubt that the environment is going to provide them those resources to help them put the right words, meaning, and context to those spaces where there was nobody there, those
mm-hmm.
terrifying spaces where the brain doesn't work all that well. The body is very efficient in living, but it has nothing to do with being alive.
Wow. Christine, I want to hear more, but I have to go into a commercial break. We'll be
sure.
right back, everyone. Let's see if I can do this.
Founded over 25 years ago to meet the needs of families in crisis, West Shields specializes in resolving adolescent issues that negatively impact the family. From preteen to young adult, we are experienced and qualified to help. We offer solutions which include referrals to a network of top professionals internationally that we work very closely with in the fields of educational consulting, psychology, and psychiatry. Our in-home crisis intervention care program helps to stabilize families and bring effective resolution. We are supported by our licensed investigation company that enables us to offer legal and expert services for locating runaway teens and more. Our therapeutic transportation services help to ensure that adolescents in crisis are safely provided transportation to specialized schools and programs with unmatched experience and success. Simply put, West Shield Adolescent Services is the best solution when your family is facing personal crisis. Call 1-800-899-8585 and let us help you.
Hi, everyone. We're back with Answers for the Family. And our guest, if you're just tuning in right now, is Christine Forner. And we are talking about disassociation and her new book. I am I'm just mesmerized by everything you just said, Christine. I have another question for you. And then
sure.
The question that I have for you is dissociation the black sheep of the, it says here,
oh,
the black
absolutely.
Sheep of the.
It really is. And it's okay. Strange because dissociation, the black sheep of the mental health family.
Yeah.
It's actually really odd because if you mention it in post-secondary institutions or you start to write about it, there's not just ignorance about it, there's almost a hostility about it. If you talk to people about even dissociative identity disorder, which is a normal thing, a thing that is as common as schizophrenia,
okay.
You get this backlash about it being made up or it's invented by the therapist. And I tell you, you know, and I've heard a man named Bessel van der Kolk say this as well, I spend years working with people telling them that they are worthy, that they are valuable, that they matter, years, and it won't change anything without a bunch of other interventions.
Mm-hmm.
So that the notion that I could change somebody's neurochemistry that much to induce a dissociative state so that the personality system cannot work together, right?
Mm-hmm.
Is just, it's strange. I find that very strange. I do find it very strange how hostile people can be about dissociation.
That's interesting. And what happens to the lower brain structures when they experience terror and fear, abandonment, all these negative emotions?
They become the dominant brain structures. They become the ruling brain structures. These are not relational brain structures. The mammalian brain is a little bit, but not on the same level of humans. So the fight and the flee and the hurt and the disconnection, those become the dominant way of being. There's an interesting study a friend of mine was telling me about out of Rwanda, looking at if child soldiers have PTSD. And they find that they actually have a really low rate of PTSD. And a wondering is if the action of the violence is keeping the PTSD at bay. And if that's the case, that actually makes sense in a lot of gang populations or a lot of violent neighborhoods, that perhaps the violence is a side effect of people being so disconnected and trying to sort of manage the chaos by being violent.
I never thought of that. We have two questions from listeners, and I always try to get them in because it's really important that they know we listen to their questions. So the first question here is from Gloria in New Mexico, and she says, my sister and her husband adopted a four-year-old child girl who's very precious, but you can tell that she did not have the touch and affection she needed from the foster families who cared for her. As sweet and as calm as she is, she's not comfortable with being hugged and receiving the normal affection they have with their other two natural children. They are hoping it's not too late to turn this around. Is this a symptom of dissociation? And if so, can your book help them?
Okay, so she's four?
She's 4 years old, a little girl.
Okay, she's four. Now, because I don't know this child, because I there's not been an assessment of it, I'm going to go a lot more general because I can't give a specific answer. But what I can say is, absolutely, if you understand that you're dealing with dissociation with a child, if their system is now, because that is a common side effect of kids, they become afraid of humans rather than understanding that humans are a source of safety and security. But at four, there are so many things that can be done if you address it and understand that it's a trauma symptom to make her system recuperate and heal from this type of trauma. I would recommend, and there are things in my book that can help the parents understand dissociation and understand what's going on in this little child if she does have dissociation. And they can also, because it really also describes what mindfulness really actually might be from an attachment or a relational perspective. So there's other things that I would recommend is very tactile things, like touching things, soft things. Another book, it's called The Happiest Baby on the Block, and it's for infants, and it's one of the strangest books, and it's not often brought in with trauma therapy, but reading the principles of that book, that there's things inside the body that are underneath the fear that are designed to calm and soothe that child, teaching that child how to soothe with gentle touch. And I mean like safe touch, collaborative touch. So another thing that they might try is having the child touch the parent first on the face or the hands or even the arms of the child, and then just asking that little one, what does this feel like? What does this seem like?
Okay.
Can you, like just getting the child to rub the adult's face, and she can maybe learn that it's safe to connect that way.
Okay.
And that connection does a lot of healing.
Okay. And the book, Happiest Baby on the Block, right? I wrote
it down. It's the weirdest little, it's an odd book about babies, but it makes sense when you look at it from a trauma perspective, and it teaches us a little something about infants that most of us don't know.
But your book will help them.
Yes, can teach them about what mindfulness is and how to use mindfulness as a way of healing, but it'll also teach dissociation and what's happening to this little peanut.
I think that is fantastic. So, Gloria, there you have your answer. you can help your sister and husband. The next question we have is from Joe from Newport Beach, and he is a school counselor. I believe that dissociative disorder with teens is at an all-time high. I have attributed their behavior to the vast changes in family dynamics, such as divorce, lack of family elders, and most of all, technology, cell phones, video games, TV, etc. It never occurred to me that something in their very early childhood might be a factor. My question is, are your techniques applicable to the other factors we are seeing? I am pushing for materials on the topics of mindfulness to present to our school administration in our next sessions with them. And perhaps your book needs to be among them.
The thing about my book is that mindfulness can be rather jarring if you have dissociation or dissociative disorders. It is really about opening up. And if these kids open these things up and there's no scaffolding or support system when we start opening up these feelings and opening up these sensations, then they'll likely just dissociate again and become this dissociative self-fueling engine.
Mm-hmm.
So the thing that I offer in my book is very short, simple methods that keep people in their window of tolerances. Window of tolerance is something that a man named Dan Siegel talks about and a woman named Pat Ogden talks about. And basically that what means is if we can tolerate it, if we can stay present and feel it, then we can sort of build this window of tolerance to build up the tolerance of being mindful. So I use a lot of imagery. I use a lot of colors. I use a different type of breathing that focuses on filling the sinus cavities versus filling the chest, because that can be really overwhelming as well.
Okay.
Something like just simple breathing can stop someone from dissociating. But if you think about dissociation, it's like you're in a dark room.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the other things like the borderline active defenses or the PTSD active defenses, when you start doing mindfulness, it's like turning on a dimmer switch so they can tolerate it better. But with dissociative disorders, it's like flicking on a white light in a dark room. It's just really intense. And so I like to bring in things that are just small, simple things that you can build on so that the brain structures that are in charge of mindfulness can grow. Mm-hmm. And then be able to help that body begin to give itself more stabilization.
Wow, amazing. All right, that's a lot of information. I still have a question about that window of tolerance, though. When you say stay present, do you mean stay present with them in the pain, help them through it, or stay present in the mindfulness part of it? Because their pain comes up, right?
Their pain what?
Their pain comes up, right? Because that's kind of what Joe was saying. They see the symptoms, but they want to kind of delve deeper. But like you said, if they delve deeper, then the problem is we are not capable of truly helping them, right? So how do we create that window of tolerance for them? Is that possible for teachers to learn to help
it
them?
Could, yes, it's possible for them to learn, absolutely.
Okay.
Being trauma-informed, so understanding what is happening to kids if they're in, like if you have an angry, active child,
mm-hmm.
Being trauma-informed can help you sort of be able to take one step back and realize, okay, not what is wrong with that child, like Oprah said, but what happened to that child. And that's the way that they cope, is in that active place. But if you have a child who's quiet or acting odd or removing, they can still be dissociating. So dissociation sort of can fit everything because it's the last line of defense. So it's on top of the active. So if you think about the active defense as a gas pedal,
mm-hmm.
dissociation's the brake. So if you take off the brake, there comes the gas. The car will take off. And if they don't have any way to support that, then they're going to go back to putting the brake on.
Okay. Could you...
What I mean by... Yeah, sorry.
Sorry, no, go ahead. You finish.
I was going to say, like, if we go back to that temperature analogy,
mm-hmm.
right, we go back to that 98 degrees. When that baby body or any type of body is in its right temperature, that would be considered a window of tolerance. They're in their optimal zone of functioning. If they start getting hot or cold, they may move up into that window of tolerance, into those active defenses, or they'll move down into the inactive defenses.
Mm-hmm.
So what we're trying to do is interventions that help them develop a window of tolerance or increase their window of tolerance by getting them used to their baseline, used to when things are optimal.
Hmm. Really interesting.
And some therapies can pop them out of their window of tolerance. And if they're out of their window of tolerance, they're not going to be learning. They're going to be defending.
Yeah, that's important. Yeah, I see that.
Yeah.
Is there for the listener something that you can think of, something that is a dissociation but a real light one that you have noticed in today's society? And I'm especially talking about today's kids in North America, whether it's, yeah.
sorry, can you ask that question again?
A
different way?
Do you know of any symptoms that you see in dissociation that truly has to do with today's world that you see pop up that you might, you know, I mean,
well,
it's different.
I think, I don't know for sure because I haven't looked into the studies and the research, but so this is just a guess.
Yeah.
It's an educated guess.
Mm-hmm.
But technology, I think, helps us dissociate further.
Okay.
Phones are a way of a body trying to regulate itself if it's dysregulated. So dysregulated is out of those window of tolerances.
Mm-hmm.
And phones can distract the system.
Okay.
So it doesn't have to feel what it feels and know what it knows.
Okay, that's interesting.
So I think, I don't know what came first, chicken or the egg. I think technology came as a side effect of how dissociated people are. But humans have been dissociated for a long, long time. If you go back even two or three generations in everybody's family, you're going to have experiences of war. You're going to have experiences of childhood trauma. You're going to have experiences of people having very difficult childhoods. And you think even 100 years ago, child labor was really, really high. Those kids are, they had to have been dissociating. I don't know on what level, but people who are living through wars, people who've been through horrors, which most people or their families or their distant families have been through. So I think you can tell by the way that the world is, there's mm-hmm. a lot of dissociation going on.
Yeah.
It's probably way more common than not dissociating.
Okay.
And I think technology is enhancing it or making it normal, sort of.
Is it enhancing it because we can hide behind it?
Yeah.
And we
probably.
Don't have to be confronted in, you know, we can hide our own symptoms, so to speak?
I think so. I think a little bit.
Aha. Okay. Wow. Really interesting. I could talk to you for hours. I want to talk to you for hours. I'm trying to get a couple of maybe something in there. Can you think of anything where you say, oh, the listener would really like to hear this? Because I have at least 30 more questions. But
I think my takeaway points would be
okay.
This. We are way more sensitive than most of us know.
Okay.
Children in particular. Children are not adults. There is nothing about the way that they work that is adult-like.
Mm-hmm.
Logic and reason don't live there yet.
Mm-hmm.
We have to teach them logic and reason. And if your child cannot logic and reason, something's gone wrong with teaching them logic and reasoning. When we're in a state of defense, we do not logic and reason. We're just trying to live. We're trying to survive.
Mm-hmm.
I think dissociation is way more common than people realize. And the human suffering that we're seeing, in part, is dissociation is walking along with them. The other takeaway that I want people to know is that there's ways to stop this. The human creature, we're very far from our natural habitat. I would love to have a time machine and go watch humans 50,000 years ago, because I don't think they'd be anything like we are today. Our human brain is designed to be very compassionate and very interdependent with other beings. That means we are supposed to be very close to other people.
Mm-hmm.
It's the thing I think we crave the most.
Mm-hmm.
What most of our love songs and our poetry and our art is about is either having love or lost love.
Mm-hmm.
Love is the thing that drives us. It's the thing we need more than food. And if we are able to give kids the dignity and the respect and the love that they crave, the world will be a different place.
Wow.
Those are my takeaways.
I agree totally. I always talk about foundation. When the foundation is missing and whatever people consider under foundation, then we are dealing with teens and what I call semi-adults, meaning they're not really adults, even though the law
says... They're not.
Yeah.
And science shows us this. Shows us this, that when there has been a trauma, the development stops. So if the traumas happen from birth, that human may grow a physical body, but all of the other developmental milestones won't be met.
No, absolutely. And I think that that is the biggest problem. We're only looking at the outer shell of the child.
Yep.
That's what we're teaching. This is what is been in schools for years and years and years. And
yep.
As parents, we seem embarrassed when our child cannot get the grades of the other siblings. And, you know, how often do I say it to a parent? Please don't say to your child that, you know, nobody in the family is bad at math except you.
We spent thousands and thousands of years hunting and gathering.
Yep.
That's really what our body was designed for. And we spent so, like a millennium, being close to our parents and caregivers. And in our world, we're leaving little babies alone at a very young age, and there's a massive consequence. The financial consequence of all of these things is unbelievable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But it's odd because then you look at countries like Mexico, and I happen to work on a kindness project with someone in Mexico, they go back to the old basics of a village. Everyone takes care of each other. I mean, we laugh kind of when we say mañana, right? But a birthday, that person is gone from work the whole week. The family celebrates the life of that person. When I see it, I have a chuckle. But to tell you the truth, I'm a little bit jealous. Not about the party part, but about the loving, nurturing part of what that entails. I'm so sorry. I have never experienced that. And I'm probably like a lot of people. I want to experience that. But that is
that
not...
That craving inside of us.
Yeah, but that's not going to happen in our part of North America.
It
right?
really needs to, especially when we have the education and the resources to understand what humans need to be efficient and to be proficient and to be kind to each other and kind to the universe and kind to the earth.
So what do we need more than being just proficient and educated? What do we need? What is it that we adults, and I'm talking really adults, everything above 35, what are we lacking? Is it truly mindfulness?
The mindfulness that I'm describing in my book really is relational, and we are missing those relationships.
Yeah.
We are so lonely.
Yeah.
And, Bowlby was one of the first people who really talked about attachment and attachment theory many, many, many years ago. And he said, human beings need love more than they need food.
Yep.
And you walk down any street, you're going to find 5 or 10 restaurants with a variety of food. You will not find one place where you can drop in and say, I feel very alone. Can you fill me?
No.
We don't have that.
Oh.
And we need that in a variety of ways.
I think Starbucks tried to create that, just so you know, a little bit. Okay, unfortunately, we have no more time on our show, but I hope personally that you will come back on Alan's show and then you will have Alan and me, hopefully, together, and because he's awesome. And he just, as you heard, was sick. And he would have loved this conversation, too. But would you tell real quickly to everyone how they can find you, how they can find your book and your website?
I'm pretty easily found, just even Googling my name, Christine Forner, because I've actually been promoted. I'm in the incoming president. I'm no longer the treasurer. I'm the incoming president of the
there
International
There you go.
Society
Congratulations.
For the study of trauma dissociation.
Okay.
My website is my initials, CF, at associatedcounseling@gmail.com. Also, my book is available on Amazon and through Routledge.
Okay. Would you repeat your email? CF and then?
Dot. associatedcounseling@gmail.com. Or no, Gmail? Yeah, gmail.com.
Okay. I wrote it down. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. And keep up the good work.
Yeah, thank you. And I would be happy to come back anytime.
We will make that happen. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. So thank you, everyone, and be sure to put us on the calendar for next Monday when our special guest will be Yvonne Talley to discuss breaking up with busy, real-life solutions for overscheduled women. So all women out there, tune in for that one. And please visit our archives and our past interviews, answersforthefamily.com, or subscribe to the show through iTunes, Stitcher, or YouTube. And please leave a review if you like what you heard. Thank you very much.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza, right here on LA Talk Radio.